And tonight on Coast to Coast, you're going to hear a story of intrigue. Hostage, kidnapped on the high seas, the true story of my captivity in Iran. Linda Davies joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Davies with us. She's also got another book out, of course, called The Ark Storm. Linda loves myths, legends, warriors of the sea. She's known for her portrayal of strong, independent, and being rebellious at times in a very strange way. She has lived in Peru for several years, the Middle East for 8 years. She writes for The Times, The Sunday Times, The Daily Telegraph, The Guardian newspapers in the UK, and the National Theater. And here she is on Coast to Coast. Linda, good morning to you.
Hi, morning, George.
So tell me about you. This is an incredible life you've lived.
Well, it's bizarre, you know. I really, most of the time, feel like I just want a quiet life, but I don't seem to have had that. So I think there must be a whole other side of my personality that's in charge. I've lived in interesting places, and that brings you into contact with interesting people, good stuff to write about. Unfortunately, quite a lot of stuff has happened directly to me, so it's you know, as a fiction writer, as a thriller writer, I like imagining terrifying plots.
Great.
And playing with characters and seeing how they could handle them. I didn't really want to have to live one myself, but clearly the fates had other ideas.
Well, we're going to go through a lot of these incredible stories in your life. I wanted to get your take, Linda, because you're out there in the United Kingdom. I've been looking at some old documentaries on Princess Diana. This is a little bit off topic or not, but did she really think that the royals were out to kill her or get her? Did you ever look into that?
I looked into it just with a passer-by interest, if you like. I personally don't think in any way the royals were out to get her. I think that Mohammed Al-Fayed, the father of Dodi Fayed, who died with her, had a conspiracy theory about that. As to whether she really thought that, I think she thought they disapproved of her, probably, and how she was living after the divorce. But being out to get her, no, I don't think that even she would have thought that. To control her, yes, but to eliminate her, no. I think that is a wild conspiracy theory.
Now, tell us a little bit about your background. Were you an investment banker before you jumped into writing?
I was. Yes, I was. I grew up in South Wales, and I had a dream, which was to be a writer. And I never met a writer. I didn't know how you went about doing it, but I did know that I needed to pay the rent in the meantime. And I went to Oxford to read politics, philosophy, and economics. And the golden coin, if you like, was investment banking. You know, that was a great glittering prize. And I thought, well, how about if I do that for a number of years, save up my running away money, and then write? That was the plan. And I trained in New York for Bankers Trust. I did leverage buyouts. And then I ultimately ended up working on the trading floor, doing junk bond trading, because I wanted to see the dynamics of how a trading floor worked, which is a story in itself. So I did it for 7 years, which was actually probably about as long as I could stand, and before I ran screaming. But I had also, during the last 6 months of those 7 years, I dreamt up the plot for what turned out to be my first novel, Nest of Vipers. And so I thought, you know, it's now or never. I was young, free, single. I had no responsibilities other than to myself. So I left, and I wrote the rest of Nest of Vipers, which was based on my idea of how to commit a massive crime in the foreign exchange markets. And luckily it worked, and I've been writing ever since.
It worked for you, and there must be some people out there that have committed huge crimes in the exchange.
Oh, there are lots, and they're far more than we get to hear about, because what tends to happen is we only hear about the crimes where masses of money were leached from the system and where banks fail. We don't hear about the crimes where people very cleverly siphon off still large amounts of cash, but not large enough to get noticed, which would have to be a lot in an investment bank, or to bring down a bank. So if they can siphon off money while continuing to deliver profits to their department, then they have a very high chance of getting away with it. So there's far more of this going on than ever comes to light. First, because the banks don't notice it, and secondly, that even when they do notice it, they really, really don't want to fess up because they don't want that kind of bad PR.
Couple of your books that I want to really get into tonight, of course, The Ark Storm and one of your new ones, Hostage, Kidnapped on the High Seas. But let's talk about The Ark Storm for a moment. Was that weather modification?
It's a variant of that. Basically, it's new technology that is several steps on from what the Russians were doing in the Cold War. It's not cloud seeding. It's much more sophisticated than that. It's basically ionizing particles in the atmosphere to create a charge, which then attracts dust particles, which in turn attract more water vapor in the air until these adhere, until they become big enough to form as droplets of rain. So it's tapping into what they call the water pipelines in the sky, in the Earth's electromagnetic field, and sucking rain out of the atmosphere, if you like. And what I became fascinated by was, you know, that technology in itself is interesting enough. What they started doing originally was putting these ionizers, which are the size of microwave machines, on masts in the desert, which is where they were first testing this, in the deserts of the Middle East. And then they decided, actually, it would be much more effective to send them up on drones. So it was at that stage that my brain was kind of doing the, you know, what if the wrong people got hold of this technology and could use it to use weather as a weapon, create a rainstorm, making a weapon. And then I heard about these things called atmospheric river storms and the whole Ark Storm 1000 scenario, which if people are interested, they can Google, which is absolutely fascinating. So it's real science, just like the weather manipulation technology is. And I thought, well, what if you could take an atmospheric river storm and ramp it up using this technology to make a superstorm? And what if that got into the wrong hands? And so that's the premise of Ark Storm.
We've got a device here in Alaska, Linda, called HAARP, H-A-A-R-P.
Yeah, I read a bit about that.
Yeah, and they've been shooting things up into the ionosphere that we don't really know what they're doing, whether it's weather manipulation. They claim it's some kind of communications device, but it is bizarre. They were going to stop funding for it. They've decided to keep funding going.
That's interesting.
But it's a strange device. Yeah. Very strange indeed.
Yeah.
But by manipulating the weather, you can also destroy nations, can't you?
Well, the stakes are big with this, yes, because if you look at it as a zero-sum game and you are taking the rain in one area, then by implication, you are depriving other areas of the rain, although people would say, well, actually, it wasn't going to fall there anyway. You know, there are these massive pipelines in the sky transporting 500 cubic kilometers of water moisture around the globe a year. So there's plenty to go around. But I'm not necessarily sure that certain nations would feel that way about it. If they had a drought and a nation some way away had lashings of rain. So, yeah, we've always worried that the world would go the direction of water wars. And water is going to be more valuable than oil one day. We know that. So this kind of technology is almost priceless.
Your books are novels, but they're based on a lot of fact and truth.
They are, because I find it fascinating. You know, it takes me between a year and 2 years to write a novel, partially because of the research. I find it fascinating delving into these different worlds. I have the financial background, so you know I still research that to keep current because I'm not an investment banker anymore, happily. But these other worlds, I do a lot of research. I travel around. I meet a lot of people, and it's fascinating. So it gives me a real opportunity to indulge my own intellectual curiosity.
Tell me about Hostage, Kidnapped on the High Seas.
Yeah, well, that's my first nonfiction book and will probably be my last, certainly in terms of memoirs. I was living in the Middle East We'd been there, my husband and three children and I, we'd been there for a year. And my husband and I, we both are slight adrenaline junkies. We got a bit more than we bargained for with this. But we thought, we love nature, we love the sea. So we thought we would buy a boat and do a bit of sailing. And so the guy who sold us the boat, who's a far more experienced sailor, came out with us on our maiden voyage.
And how big was it? How big was the boat?
It's 38.
I had a 22-footer. And so 38-footer is a big boat.
It's a big boat. It was meant, the idea was that we would have lovely family holidays on this boat. But, you know, we had three young children, and we didn't want to take them out on this first voyage. We wanted to check that you know, everything was fine, the boat sailed fine and everything. So off we go on the last day of Ramadan, which is quite a charged day, if you like, and that everyone's got low blood sugar. The Muslims have been fasting during daylight hours for months. Off we go. We thought the biggest danger there was negotiating the roads with lots of low blood sugar drivers screaming around. But off we go sailing. We're sailing in the Persian Gulf, Arabian Gulf, depending on your perspective. It is a strategic waterway. If you look at the maps, it's a very narrow passage through which most of the oil transported in the world flows through. But that's where we were living. That's where we went sailing. And we unfortunately ran into two naval patrols.
Iranian.
The Iranian Navy. And they are very opportunistic. So they, you know, they came screaming out of nowhere, boarded our boat. And, you know, you don't argue with lots of young, highly excited guys brandishing AK-47s. So, you know, we were boarded.
Oh my God.
And it went from bad to worse. I mean, very often in these situations, it's the first 24 hours that are the most critical. Although every situation every hostage situation is obviously very different. But you know, at one stage, I think they thought that we were a problem that was just best made disappear. And as night fell, they made us motor out away from this island where they'd taken us into.
With the children? Do you have the children?
No, the children were home. No.
Thank
we
God.
Left the children at home. Thank goodness. So, no. That was a major blessing. We'd left the children at home. This was just to test the boat, you know, until we felt comfortable with it before we took the children out on sails closer to home. You know, we never intended to do sails like that with them.
Sure.
And we, you know, we were told to motor out to sea. There were the two gunboats, each on one side, and then one gunboat roared away. The other gunboat, the guys lined up on the side, made us line up, and they readied their weapons. And we basically thought,
This is it.
Their radios crackled into life, and they obviously got other instructions because their demeanor completely, you know, they lowered their weapons. The other boat appeared, and they told us to motor back into the island. And then we stayed there overnight with them on board. And the next day, a military jet flew in, and there were much more senior interrogators who basically took over.
Thinking you were, what, British spies or something?
Yes, yeah. But they thought we were. So, you know, we had to convince them that we were not spies, that we were just tourists. But, you know, the Iranian outlook is very suspicious. That's the way they live, in that their own country is, there's so much spying, domestic spying on their own citizens as they try and desperately keep control of their country. And then there's a lot of overseas spying that goes on the part of the Iranians as well. So they're programmed, if you like, to think that everyone's a spy. And we had to convince them that we weren't. And happily, we managed to do that.
How long did they hold you?
They held us for 2 weeks in different places. So we had a night on the boat, and then we were flown out with these guys to a naval base in a place called Bandar Abbas, which is a big seaport and a big naval base. And we were kept on that naval base in a safe house, heavily guarded, for 10 days and interrogated by a series of different ministries that flew in with ever higher officials from the regime. Luckily, not the Revolutionary Guard side. And one of the interesting things about it was that the guys who interrogated us, I mean, they were multiple, you know, there was the Ministry of Justice, the Ministry of Interior, the Foreign Ministry, and more that I can't even remember. But it wasn't the Revolutionary Guard side. And all these different ministries actually kept us deliberately away from the Revolutionary Guard, I think for two reasons. One, if we were going to be useful, they wanted us to be useful for them.
Right.
And two, I think when they did realize that we weren't spies, that we were innocent, they wanted to protect us. They wanted to keep us away from these people because there was a lot of cloak and dagger stuff. When we were moved in such a way, not just to hide from any of our own side, I think, but to be hidden from the Revolutionary Guard side. And that was quite scary to see, you know, one section of Iran of the other.
And did they separate you from your husband or could you stay together?
We were interrogated separately and we did spend about 12, 14 hours a day being interrogated. But we were given a room together. So we subsequently discovered that, you know, as we suspected, the whole house was bugged for sound and vision. Mercifully, I think not the bathrooms, and we managed to communicate in the shower. That was the only place we could actually communicate about anything.
Did you think this was it, beyond the arming on the boat, that somewhere along the line of this 2-week endeavor that they were going to kill you?
There was another occasion when we were being moved, as I mentioned, when we were moved, it was a very cloak and dagger thing. And we had been told that we were going to meet, this was after about 10 days, we were going to meet representatives of our embassy. And, you know, it had taken a long time for us to manage to get word out to our embassy that we were actually being held, that we hadn't drowned at sea and disappeared because, you know, our boat disappeared. We disappeared. Nobody could reach us.
Well, your poor kids, too, must have thought.
Our kids, I mean, you know, for 5 days, our cell phones were taken off us and we weren't allowed. And, you know, I begged the captors and after 5 days, they let me ring our children, but they said, you've got to tell them that you have engine problems. And so that was the...
And they're standing right by you, right?
Yes, they're standing right by us. And I kept up that fiction for a few days. But then when we were still getting nowhere, I actually just blurted out not to the kids, but to the lady who was taking care of them at that stage, that we were being held by the Iranians in Bandar Abbas as hostages. And, of course, all hell broke loose. And then, you know, we weren't allowed our phones. And then a few days later, they gave it back under stricter instructions with all sorts of threats.
When they let you go, Linda, what did they finally say? I mean, and how did they say it? Was it a friendly goodbye or was it get out of here?
Because there were two times when we thought we were going. The first time was after the 10 days when we were meant to be going to the airport in Bandar Abbas. The two guys who I call in my book, Reza and Ali, I've changed their names, they wished us well, and they, one of the things when you are a hostage, you try and do, and this is something patently the poor guys being held by ISIS cannot do, is establish a common humanity with your captors.
Mm-hmm.
I say that because ISIS clearly lacks all common humanity. But we had established a common humanity with these guys, and they knew we were family people, and I think they were extremely pleased to see us go, and, you know, they wished us well. And, you know, we were re-detained then at the airport by a thoroughly nasty, nasty bunch. But the other person who was very interesting was an admiral, a very senior figure in the regime. And I think it was on his say-so that we were released. And, you know, he just said, yes, basically, go get out of here before the Revolutionary Guard.
Yeah, get you.
Find
and
out
then you're
that
gone.
You're here. You know, we're trying to get you out really, really fast. You know, sadly, the word had got out to another part of the regime, and they came and intercepted proceedings, and then we were taken to Tehran. And so the story goes on.
All right, hold on, Linda. We'll talk more about this, and I want to get your reaction to this ISIS situation as well. We'll be back. Well, our television show is called Beyond Belief, and you can watch it absolutely free, 10 days worth. Take advantage of looking at all of the programs we've done, and we've done many. Simply go to this website, beyondbelief.com. Welcome back. Linda Davies with us, talking about her works, Hostage and the Ark Storm and so many others. Her website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, lindadavies.com. Did you come away from this experience liking the Iranians, Linda, or not?
I'll preface that with the fact that I, especially when I worked as an investment banker, I had a lot of Iranian friends. Mm-hmm. And including some who had fled the revolution, one in particular whose father was hanged after the Shah was deposed.
Yeah.
And they had strong, you know, very strong feelings of Iran, loving their homeland, but hating the regime. And so I was very curious whilst I was there, despite the horror and the terror and all those other aspects of it, to have a look at the regime from the inside. It was a very weird perspective. And a lot of the individuals that, and we did meet many people because, as I say, we were interrogated by multiple agencies, and as well as the interrogators, we had a changing cast of guards who were always with us. And most of those were very decent people. I think they felt themselves, to a certain extent, prisoners of their regime. I mean, I'll give you one little example. When we thought we were going to be freed the first time, the guys, Reza and Ali, who had been in charge of our interrogations, came and told us this. And, of course, we were overjoyed. And I know a reasonable amount about Islam, and I know you're not meant to sort of touch family members who are non-family members. But I shook this guy's hand because I was so delighted.
And you're a woman, right?
And I'm a woman. And we weren't released that day, but they came in the day after and they said, oh, we think it's going to be today. But he very much kept his distance as if I had the plague. And I realized that he must have been, and he looked chastised. This must have been seen. And he must have been.
Somebody brought it up to him.
Chastised,
yeah.
for shaking my hand, for touching me. And actually, when I was there, I was delighted that they were living by that stricture as to,
well, I was going to ask you that because, yeah. You know, you're a woman, you're in captivity. God knows what would happen if you were kidnapped by somebody else.
Yes, I mean, thank goodness it was the regime. Now, the regime comes in many different guises, and like I said, they are the good parts, if you like, and there are the very bad parts. And just because you're held by the regime doesn't mean that they're going to behave honorably. We know that. But these guys pretty much did. There were some later on who, you know, my husband got roughed up. And there were some of the ones that we came into contact with in Tehran were very, very unpleasant. But for the most part, they were good people. They were frightened of the regime themselves. And, you know, with good reason, when you see what's happening, I mean, you know, some of the latest things that have been going on, you know, a woman has been sentenced to, whatever, 50 lashes, and she's imprisoned for going to a basketball match.
Yeah, strange.
Another one has been imprisoned for promoting feminism. That is a crime.
And Saudi Arabia is no better.
No, Saudi has. Interestingly, though, Saudi is a country that is profoundly religious, and actually, Iran is far more secular. Yes, it is being controlled by religious leaders, but they are using religion as a tool of control there. It's a very different country from Saudi. Saudi, as I say, is much more fundamentalist. It's
sure.
Much more. It is genuinely religious with all that brings.
Well, you know, most of the Iranians, as you know, Linda, love our way of life. They love it, and I think most of them would prefer to live that way. But they're trapped.
They are trapped. They are, and the mullahs and those in control know that they have to keep a very tight rein on their populace. To stay in power and to keep the status quo, and that's what they do. That's why, you know, a few years ago when there were the demonstrations, they cracked down incredibly hard on the protesters, and, you know, left people dead, imprisoned, and any hint of protest on social media, and people are arrested and thrown into prison, and very often not heard of again.
You know, and if the people knew how much these mullahs were probably pocketing on their oil money, they'd go crazy.
Yeah. Well, Iran should be a rich country. It produces 3 million barrels of oil a day. One of the first things I noticed when we did land in Bandar Abbas was the incredible contrast between Dubai, which has no oil wealth really, but its wealth comes from tourism, and Iran, which has 3 million barrels a day, but looks like a third world country. And I thought, where is all the money going? And it's going to fund their military program.
That's right. And their pockets.
And to fund Hamas and Hezbollah and their overseas terrorist forays, and lining their pockets. It certainly isn't being spent on the average person.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has said it again that Iran is not going to get any kind of atomic bomb, and I feel as if at some point, sooner than later, Israel is going to do something to stop that. And I think all heck is going to break loose. I mean, we could be on the cusp of a third world war.
Yes, yes, we could. I understand how incredibly fraught it is. And I also applaud the clever efforts to disrupt the nuclear program via the Stuxnet bug that attacked the centrifuges and so on.
Yeah.
I think that's one way. The other way is to keep channels of discussion and negotiation open. I've always been against treating Iran as a pariah state and shutting off channels of communication. You know, we are only free because channels of communication existed. We would be unlikely to have been freed if there hadn't been those channels between the UK Foreign Office and the Iranian Foreign Office. And now we're in a situation because of ISIS, where our government, your government, are potentially going to be in discussions and have already been actually with the Iranians about how to tackle ISIS. And the other scary thing now is that ISIS says that they're going to go after Iran's nuclear technology and try and get hold of it. Now that is far more frightening.
Well, it sure is. So it's going to be an interesting road, I think, over the next year to see what happens. I want to get your reaction to what is going on now in the Middle East with ISIS. Is there a major concern in Britain of any terrorist activity anymore? I know they just broke one up.
Very much so. Yes, very, very much so. There's just been a new head of MI6 appointed, who has very considerable counter-terrorist experience. That's Islamic terrorism is the number one priority, and attacks are being foiled all the time that we don't get to hear about, thank goodness. And so we take the threat of ISIS and the returning fighters and the radicalization incredibly seriously. I think there's a lot more we could do on the de-radicalization front. One of the crazy ideas, and this actually might be a good one, is to take some of the returning fighters who are thoroughly disillusioned with it and get them to show and to talk about the true horrors of jihad. I think that that in their own communities might be much more powerful, an inducement to actually turn away from it. That combined with obviously prosecuting rigorously any people who cross the line.
Do you think that this is going to get worse or better? Because to me, my feeling is this thing could go on for years.
Yeah, I think it's a very long-term problem. I think all the military strategists say tackling ISIS, they're not sure it can be done just with aerial attacks. They think that, I mean, we know that there are ground forces there anyway. They're small ground forces, but they have to be to direct in the air attacks and to get the intelligence. But it's not going to go away anytime soon. All we're doing to a certain extent is sticking a plaster on a wound. But we got to keep doing everything we can do. Use all the resources at our disposal, and because of our great intelligence network, electronic as well as human, we have got avenues into these people to tackle them, and we need to follow those, and we need to stay hopeful. It is tempting sometimes to think all I can do is retreat and hide, you know, hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil, because this is such a massive problem. But I think we fight it as piecemeal as we can, and also we discuss with the nations in the region, and we push them to fight it themselves, because it's trouble in their backyard, and they really need to do their bit too.
And back to Wall Street for a second here, Linda. You know, the fiasco that occurred in 2008, of course, with these mortgage-backed securities.
Yeah.
I think they're doing it all over again. I mean, they seem to be financing people who shouldn't be financed and bundling these things up again. Has anything changed?
I'm not so sure it has. I really hope the oversight is tighter. But, you know, I wrote it's been 20 years since Nest of Ibis came out, and I've written a 20th anniversary preface for it, in which I maybe hubristically tried to look at what's happened in the financial world over the past 20 years and what lessons have been learned and what has changed. And I always come at it from the point of view of psychology, and I don't think the psychology of the players has changed. That psychology is always to push the envelope. It's always it's driven by greed. There's no question. You know, why are people who are already so wealthy still greedy to make more? It's a game.
More and more.
Yeah. And money is the marker, you know, and money is the marker of success, and more money is the marker of more success. So it's at a given stage, it just becomes a game, and they want to make more. And if they can, they will. And everybody was complicit in what happened in 2008. You know, the government, the regulators, the rating agencies, and to a certain extent, the people who borrowed themselves without a realistic hope of ever being able to pay it back. So, you know, greed is behind what happened, and human greed hasn't really gone away. And the regulators to deal with that are going to have to be much more proactive, as are the governments. But, you know, the governments, they enjoy the tax state when the revenues from financial business go up, and to a certain extent, they look away.
Is there a frustration in the United Kingdom like there is here in the United States? People are just kind of fed up.
Yes. And when you look at how much governments have bailed out the financial system.
Oh, my God.
I completely understand that, you know. People are fed up. The anti-banker sentiment, I think, has waned a bit, because it's just not possible to keep up that level of intensity. But I do think the financial system, you know, we have a great capitalist system, and I am a strong, fervent capitalist. But for capitalism's own sake, we have to keep our house in order. And it's not in order. Self-interest makes me say, apart from the justice of the situation, that we need to clean up our act. And I really don't think we are doing that scrupulously enough.
Linda, with what went on with you in the Middle East and what's been going on in the Middle East right now, would you move back there? Or are you done?
Oh, I love Dubai. And that's where we lived. And I have to say, the United Arab Emirates are a very successful model of moderate Islam. Now, they have their own troubles and their own challenges. And, you know, they need to free up their private sector. They need to strengthen create an independent judiciary so that there is more private sector enterprise, and so that they stop relying as heavily as they have been on oil revenue, which will be diminishing. So they need to develop a more participatory system of representation. You know, at the moment they're not autocracies, although, you know, if you put them at one end of the spectrum, obviously you're going to pick that end. There is a limited amount of access to the rulers. They have a marginalist system, which is what the Middle East has always operated under, where anybody can go and see the prince, the sheikh, and put his cause to them. Now, the issue is, obviously, as the populations get larger, that's very difficult to do logistically. But it has worked very well historically. It's now being challenged. So they need to work on that. But what it does mean is that on a day-to-day basis, living there is very pleasant. You don't want to fall foul of the regime, because the judicial system is far from perfect. But if you stay on the right side and you don't cross the wrong people, which there's no reason really why you should, you can have a wonderful life there in conditions of moderate Islam. I have to say, I felt a lot safer living in Dubai than I did in Notting Hill, where I was mugged violently one time in front of my then 5-year-old son.
Jeez.
They have a zero tolerance attitude to crime. And it shows you can walk the streets in most of Dubai and feel very, very safe.
Do you think, because crime is at the minimal there, and there's no terrorism, yet it would be easy to be a terrorist there. I mean, everything's out in the open. Do you think that they're buying people off just so there's no problems there?
They're very clever. Dubai, for instance, has decided it's handed over the entire defense of the United Arab Emirates to Abu Dhabi. So it doesn't have to spend any money on defense infrastructure. What it does spend it on is intelligence and civic intelligence as well. So when you're walking around your streets of an evening, having a walk, people exercising their dogs or going for a run or whatever, every so often a car will go by, and I got to know the cars they drove, and I got to know some of the guys. The civil defense will drive by and keeping an eye on things.
Like a cop will do here.
Yeah, like a cop would. And lots of police cars would drive by as well. But this is a different level of intelligence. And they get to know what's going on in the community and who's doing what and who's visiting whom. And there are many eyes and ears. And they do, when they get to hear of radical activity or potential terrorist activity, they deal with it. Don't ask me how they deal with it, and I'm not always sure I want to know.
No, that's probably pretty stern.
Yeah, they deal with it, and the problem is solved. And yeah, I know civil liberties people will be screaming at me for appearing to condone this, but you have that extreme where, you know, as far as I'm concerned, your liberty extends as far as my nose, and these people are trying to cut off a lot more than your nose. So we need to respond, and we need to respond very robustly to that. And that's a dialogue that needs to be strengthened. This is the way that Dubai deals with it. And to date, they've dealt with it very successfully, and they've given a country that, and please long may it remain, that's been free of terrorist activity in terms of atrocities.
You know, as we're speaking, ISIS is taking a town in Syria near the Turkish border. And I'm wondering, where is Assad and his military? How is he allowing this to happen within Syria? It's almost like he has no control.
Well, he's fighting on so many different fronts, I suppose. And the other thing about ISIS is when you look at how horribly successful they have been just on the military front, you're talking here, really, I suspect, of people who were in the Iraqi army. These are not just ragbag sign-up jihadis. These are trained fighters. And so Assad would be fighting highly experienced now, trained fighters. And he's just spread too widely on too many different fronts. ISIS are incredibly well-funded. So, you know, they were well-funded anyway from donors in the region, but now, thanks to their possession of oil wells, you know, they're sitting on over $1 billion. So they're well-funded, they're well-trained, they are constantly recruiting. And also, just a little aside, if a lot of the social media in Saudi is very supportive of ISIS. So they are horribly successful on the recruitment.
They sure are. Stay with us, Linda. We're going to continue chatting with you in the final hour. Plus, we'll take some phone calls with you. Linda Davies with us. A couple of her works, Hostage and the Ark Storm.